Hello and welcome to episode 31 of the DX Mentor, all about the expedition to Lakshadweep and Andaman Islands. Thank you for joining us. I'm Bill, AJ8B. If this is the first time you're with us, welcome. We have a back catalog of over 30 episodes for you to join on our podcast and YouTube channel, all about DX and various topics of DX. Krish, W4VKU, operated from the Lakshadweep Islands, which is Asia 011, as VU7 Alpha during December 4th to the 15th of 2023. He then moved to the Andaman Islands as VU4 November during December 16th through 26th of 2023. So for this episode, my guests are Krish, W4VKU, and Joe, W8GEX. Krish will tell us all about his two expeditions and the adventures at both locations, including his run-in with bootleggers. You don't want to miss that. So without any further delay, let's get started. Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the DX Mentor. I am so excited. This is yet another first for us. We have a top flight DXer who is fresh from two fairly rare de-expedition islands that he was at. I don't know that his bags are unpacked yet, but he's agreed to be with us, and I couldn't be more appreciative. And I'm going to set aside a very cold beverage for you. If you come to Dayton, it'll be my treat, and I'll take care of you. But first, we have, of course, as always, we have Joe, W-A-G-E-X. Joe, you want to introduce yourself?
Well, I think everybody pretty knows me, but we'll do it again.
All right.
Yeah, I'm Joe, W-A-G-E-X, and been the co-host with Bill on all these podcasts for way over a year now. And if anybody's been around and listened to all of our podcasts, that I'm a DXer all the way. Ever since I got my technician class back in 1970, I started DXing on 6 meters and been absolutely hooked ever since. Been on several D expeditions, some just by myself and others with 15 and 20 people. And it's just in my blood for sure. So that's my story, Bill.
All right, great. And our special guest is Krish, W4VKU, I think otherwise known as VU4VKU, if I have that right. Krish, tell us about yourself and tell us how you got into ham radio.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Just a minor correction. I would have loved to have the VU4VKU call. Unfortunately, the Indian authorities will not issue that as a permanent. So it's VU2VKU, right?
All right.
So no, all good. Thank you for having me, Bill and Joe. So what do you want me to start, Bill?
How did you get into radio?
Oh, good question, right? I was about like 12 years old, and this was back in 1982 when, the equivalent for the Olympics in Asia, they have the Asian Games, right? So in 1982, the Asian Games was actually hosted in New Delhi. So they were actually selling like these little pocket transistor radio kits. So somehow, I don't know how it dawned, but I like to build little circuits and other things, when I was 12. So my dad got me a kit. I don't know, it was like $4 or so. So I tried to put that together, and I've been fascinated with the concept of radio. And there is the All India Radio transmitters not far from where I used to live. I used to see all those curtain arrays. So I was fascinated once I was able to get the radio working. And then it turned around like, okay, how can I transmit? I'm receiving. How can I transmit? How can I talk to other folks, right? So it started there. And somehow, again, this is before the era of the internet. So everything you got to find, some paperback material to learn anything new. Then I learned about ham radio from, I don't know, some article somewhere, but back then there was no facility to do what's needed in order to qualify for a license. So I had a sheet of paper where I wrote all the Morse code, dots and dashes, but didn't know how to practice it without the key and all that. But then back in 1988, when I actually left town, went to another town for undergrad. There was a club station. I don't know, some of the old timers might have worked Victory Uniform to Charlie Bravo Echo. Mm-hmm. And it was sponsored by the big DX at then, Victory Uniform to Germany, Delta Germany, back in those days. So the club station was there, and they had a caretaker who was out there and offering classes every day. So when I get off the college, stay there, take the classes, and then I think a few months later I got my license back in 1989. So that's how I got into radio and then eventually got the ham radio license as well. Bill, I'll pause and see if you have any questions.
Yeah, so there's always a big jump though from just getting your ham license to really starting to chase DX. So what kind of got your appetite to really start chasing DX around the world?
That's a good question, Bill. So back after I got my ham radio license, and occasionally I used to go to the club station and operate. This is one of those things I tell everyone, right? Like when you're a student, you have time and no money, right? So I used to have a little radio. I used to do more of broadcast listening to, you know, stations all over the world, get QSL cards. So it used to be a lot of fun. And then once I started working, was able to pick up radio. But by the time I started working, I was here over in the States. And then you have the issue with the associations and antenna restrictions and all that. So had a radio in my apartment, used to run wires out into the trees. Someone used to go and snip the wires. I used to go redo them. So that's how it started, started DXing. This was back up in Northern Virginia. And then I moved to Carolina, was able to install, you know, somewhat decent antennas here. But the real bug kicked in when there was an opportunity to partake in the first VU7 expedition in a long time. This was back in 2006. The Amateur Radio Society of India at that time was able to organize a trip. That was the VU7 Lima Delta. Because there was a long period of time where no one was allowed to operate from VU7. I don't know, for like 14, 15 years, something like that. Then they opened up. So they were looking for operators that had VU7 call sign to be a part of the team. So I had the opportunity to join that team. And I was like, okay, this is fun, right? It's like you got a lot of folks doing the same stuff and all the challenges. And so it was a lot of fun. So did that and then came back. And then in 2011, there's a second opportunity. The club again put together a trip to VU4. So that was the VU4 Papa Bravo. So joined that one. Again, it was fun. Both these locations had different challenges. And so it was interesting. And subsequent to that, and I had fought some good connections. And there was the old man, VU2 PAI, who is now Silent Key. So he was game. He would say like, hey, you want to go somewhere? Let's go. So that's when like back later, 2 years later, in 2013, we thought, let's go to Maldives and hang out, right? So that's when we rounded up all the two stations, carted it. We go through the customs and the guy asked like, are you going to take all of this back with you when you leave? I said like every single bit of it has to go back, right? So we had like over 100+ kilos for two stations. So it was a good time. So we did that 2013 and then had permission for VU7 because if you look at the gap between 2006 to the next VU7, we were not sure if they would give us a permission for anyone else that applies for outside of the society. So 2013, I just threw a piece of paper and luckily got permission. So coming out from Maldives, I think a day later, I fly to VU7 and, you know, so got a hang of the location and the logistics. So that was 2013. And then we were able to do the VU7 AG that year. Okay. With a broader team. So with that being done, then the next year we thought, let's try, now that we got VU7 activated, let's try VU4. So try to apply again, got permission for 2014 solo trip, did the VU4K. For a few days. And then the same year, we were able to take a larger team and activate VU4KV from the Andamans. And I think the IOTA folks were actually asking to go to Campbell Bay, which is Greater Nicobar down south, because that's a different IOTA and has not been activated since, I believe, the 2004 tsunami time frame. So VU2PA and I, PI, we went down there and activated that for like 10 days, came back, and then we activated VU4KV. So that was 2014. And 2017, just we thought, like, let's go to a different island in the VU7 chain, because certain islands were off limit to foreigners, right? So I went to a different location thinking maybe I'll take K3LP and a few other folks with me. It never panned out, but sadly, but that was again in 2017. So I laid low, and then old man V2PI passed away in 2019. So was like, okay, what the heck? I don't have as much excitement anymore, so just laid low. And but then the it's been a long duration time frame between the last activation versus now, and the conditions were good, so I thought, okay, let's try to do something, right? So, and I'll pause, and then I'll add a little bit more color to the specifics about the two operations, but I'll pause and see if you have any questions, Bill and Joe.
Wow.
So, what other D expeditions have you been on besides VU 4 and 7?
8 cubic, it's pretty much in that same location, Joe.
Okay.
So wanted to expand a little bit more, and I was working with some of our friends in XU, right, to see if I could get a trip to Cambodia. Been there once. Unlucky that, they changed the rules because of certain things that happened there with other folks that had gone there and misused the license, the permission, right?
Yeah.
Still hopeful that, we'll get permission someday and we'll be able to activate it. But still trying. This Sunday, heading off to Cuba to join the Tango 42 Tango for the ARRL International DX contest.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that's coming up shortly. So that's the only big one. Still trying. See what pans out, Joe and Bill.
So you're pretty well connected. Do you know anybody in North Korea?
You know what? I've been sending out some feelers, right? But there is an outfit that actually organizes trips to North Korea, like more of tour packages. And I was trying to ask them, like, hey, do you happen to know anyone in North Korea, right? Because I'm trying to see if by any chance we could do some ham radio. They came back and said, like, oh, we know what ham radio is. There's another group that has tried this. I will tell you this. I will take you for a trip. You can go and see North Korea, but my friend, it's not with your radio. So, and then I think the second one was like, okay, what about Turkmenistan, right? Like, it's the same thing. In Turkmenistan, you'll never get an answer, right? So there is
Yeah.
that. So it's, yeah, but got to
Couple
keep trying,
of tough ones. So when you were on that Lac Shwat, I'll never say it correctly, Lac Shwat people, right?
Lackadaisical work, right? Yeah.
Okay. And just if someone's not sure, I had an idea where it was, but I didn't realize that it's in the Arabian Sea, right? Which surprised me a little bit. And it's off the west coast of India. And it looked like it was probably pretty hot there based on its location above the equator.
And now let's pause for a word from ICOM. Put a spring in your step with ICOM. Spring is when you get outside and work out the kinks in your station. Whether you need to fix ice damage to your Yagi or get prepared for an upcoming VHF contest, ICOM has the radios for you. Consider the IC7610. Upgrade your station with one of ICOM's fabulous HF radios, including the IC7610. With the 7610, faint signals are no longer challenging for DXers and contesters. The high-performance RMDR can pick out the faintest of signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. This is the SDR every ham wants. You could also look at the IC905. With ICOM's 905 mobile, VHF contesting is a breeze. This all-mode rig covers 5 bands with one radio: 2 meters, 70 centimeters, 1.2 gig, 2.4 gig, and the 5.6 gigahertz bands. And you can add the optional CX10G transverter to cover 10 gigahertz. This radio features a large touchscreen with real-time, high-speed spectrum scope, and waterfall display, easy D-Star settings, and a separate controller and RF module configuration to reduce signal loss. You can explore the world of microwave with the IC905. You might also consider the IC705 and the 7300. These two rigs are the go-to rigs for outdoor hams who love POTA and SOTA activations. Both radios feature a large touchscreen with real-time spectrum scope and waterfall display for intuitive function and setting operations. Specifically, the IC705 provides base station features and performance in the palm of your hand. From HF to 50, 144, or 440 MHz, enjoy a variety of bands in the D-Star DV, sideband, CW, RIDI, AM, and FM modes. This handheld also includes an RF direct sampling system, wide area LAN, and Bluetooth connectivity with an internal GPS receiver, and more. The IC7300 is an industry first to use an RF direct sampling system in an entry-level HF radio. This high-performance radio includes an audioscope function, IP+, class-leading RMDR, and phase noise characteristics, 15 discrete bandpass filters, and a built-in antenna tuner. This compact and innovative radio will far exceed your expectations. The real HF fun starts with the IC7300. If you are getting a head start on hurricane season, ICOM's IC7100, ID5100, ID50, or ID52 are the perfect traveling companions and should be on your go-kit list. The ID58 gives hours of fun and enjoyment working with your favorite bands. Beginners will love the easy D-Star settings, band scope and waterfall display, voice messaging, and share picture function, and use the same optional accessories as the 52, 51, and ID31. The ID52A is a VHF-UHF dual bander with D-Star and FM dual mode functions and is the first handheld amateur radio with a full-color 2.3-inch waterfall display. This radio has a guaranteed range of 144 to 148 and 440 to 450 MHz and supports conventional FM communications and D-Star simplex, repeater, regional, and worldwide calls over the D-Star Internet Gateway. The ID52A is also the perfect companion to the IC705. Both use compatible headsets, batteries, and the same Android app for D-Star operation. ICOM's compact IC7100 and IC5100 D-Star mobiles are road-ready and feature dash-mountable touchscreen control heads with quick and straightforward one-touch operation, keeping you connected wherever you roam. The IC7100 is an HF, VHF, UHF multiband all-mode mobile with an angled control head, a large internal speaker for clear digital audio, and it fully covers the HF, 50, 144, and 430 to 440 MHz amateur bands in multiple modes, providing 100 watts on HF and 50 MHz, 50 watts on 2 meters, and 35 watts on 430, 440 MHz. The IC5100 is a VHF-UHF dual-band mobile with DV-DV, dual-watch, Bluetooth, and an integrated GPS receiver. For high-powered base stations to compact and travel-friendly handhelds, our radios offer in-demand features and functions to keep you active on the bands inside your shack or out in the field. For the love of ham radio, you can check the show notes and you'll see links to all of these excellent ICOM products, and I'd recommend you do that.
It is, Bill. In fact, so the time frame from May till October to mid-November is sort of like the monsoons down there. In fact, some of the transportation, they scale down as well, like the ferry schedule from the mainland, they scale it down. So December, it's hot, but it's not extremely hot. It's still, you know, very pleasant, I would say, from December to January. So wasn't too bad. In fact, I would say like I got very lucky this time with the whole logistics, that the weather was very favorable, right? Like I you know, my home is back in Chennai, which is on the east coast. In the east coast. I left Chennai and it rains in Chennai and they lose power for 2 days. And I'm blessed with good weather back at, it's Lakshadweep. It's like 100,000 islands is what it expands to. So I was blessed with good weather and got all the equipment out of Lakshadweep back to mainland and I head back to Chennai. Then they get rained out and, you know, they had some weather pattern come in and they get rained out in Lakshadweep and Kochi, which is the coastal city, right? So yeah, it was good. And luckily, you know, weather cooperated. So I think the stars might have aligned, at least from that perspective, got lucky, you know.
Well, and I got lucky too because I was able to work you while you were there, and that was my first one. So thank you for that.
Yes, I did too, so thanks.
Yeah, so were you the only operator on this one?
Yeah, so I'll share how this kind of kicked in, right? Well, so in the past, any trip, the logistics with hauling the equipment is the biggest headache, right? But it just adds up, like, hey, maybe I need this, maybe I need this, right? It just, and Joe would know, right? Like, it just adds up. And it's like buying insurance, right? You need it. It's better to have it than not need it and use it, right? But rather than not have it when you need it, right? So it adds up. One of the heavier weight component is like the coax cables, right? The coax cables are heavy. So I was thinking, like, how do I cut short the amount of coax that I carry, right? So that was one. The second is, in the past, I've tried with a group, and we've never hit, past like the 50,000 to 60,000 QSO mark. So I was trying to see, like, what can we do optimize, right? Over the years, and we've kind of improvised on the approach as well, learning from some of the other expeditions, like, what can you do better? So that was one motivator. And the second was, Club Log has this CAS award, right? So, and I was of the opinion that maybe I can take a shot at the single op category. I don't think I can cut it with a multiple operator team. So with a single op, I thought, okay, let me take a shot. So that was one. And in my attempt to cut the amount of coax and the number of antennas that are installed, right? Like, so that was something I was trying to figure out what can be done. And then you have the FT8 that came in. I had a little badge somewhere. I went to Visalia last year, and someone gave me a badge saying, like, FT8, it had a strike through, saying, like, no FT8. So, and I share this, like, all day I work on a computer, so I don't want yet another computer. I need something with knobs, right? So I don't want yet another mode when I'm going and clicking a computer. But what got me hooked on with FT8 was the literally extracting intelligence out of noise, right?
Yes.
That was pretty fascinating. So then and again, most often I just operate SSB. I chase DX in CW with CW, but not a CW operator. So I was thinking, like, well, if this is great, like, even with a low power, you're able to get low band signals across, then it's pretty efficient. And so the CAS award, trying the single operator category, trying to optimize on the amount of coax carried, trying to use FT8, and also it kind of supplements the need for CW. So I thought, okay, let's go and try. The goal is to hand out an all-time new one to as many folks, new slots, whatnot, right? So if I can do it FT8, why not, right? So that was the goal on this trip, and I'm more than happy to elaborate a little bit more on how I was able to put it all together. So I'll pause.
Yeah, I would be curious about that. And I think your comment's a really good one. There's a lot. I know there's a lot of people that aren't. Well, there's some people that aren't fans of FT8, and I do think though, when you look at the technology behind it, it is truly amazing. The mathematics and the error recovery and everything else. And I wish for that alone, people are a little more open to it. But that's all right. I like it. I use it. So, and thank goodness you use it. And my hat's off to you because I would assume that you had some pretty severe pileups, and yet this is the first time you're jumping into the FT8 water. So I'm not that courageous, I don't think.
So I'll share some more of the logistics, right? So, and I had done some level of testing before I left. Like, for example, the vertical antennas, trying to get like a single, single, how do you optimize the amount of time it takes to set up a station and get on the air quick, right? Because the time allocated, it's like 10 days or whatever is the time that you get permission for. And then I need to account for the time it takes to travel and then set it up, tear it down. And I just have only that much vacation time going over from the States, right? So what I did was, I tried to set up the 160 meter, 80 meter vertical at home here in the backyard, test it. I tried to see if I could actually squeeze 40 meter in there as well, but then there was interaction, so I could not. It was too much time spent. The goal was to make it very deterministic and predictable. Once you set it up, I know I can tune it quick and get it to the spot where it needs to be resonant, right? So 8160 played pretty good. 8075, I had to pick and choose on which one I was going to go on, which was fine. Then I had a second vertical for the 30 and 40 meter band. Then I had a third one, the DX Commander, for the 20 to 10. The hex beam is great because, you know, every time you put it together, it works, right? Yeah. Six bands, you have it. There were some 6 meter folks that were asking me, and I tried to build a 6 meter Yagi, but it was raining all along in Chennai, and it took me a lot of time to actually even pack up all the stuff because I have so much gear back in view, and which has not been used in like many years. So it takes time to take it out from storage, pack it all up, and then prepare it for shipping. And it kept raining, so I didn't have the time to build the 6 meter Yagi. And I thought, okay, well, at least the hex has two elements on it for what it's worth. You know, whoever can hear me, let's work with them, right? So I had the 160-80 vertical, 80-40 vertical, 30-40, 20 to 10 was a vertical, and then the 20 to 6 hex beam. So that was like four antennas. And then folks were asking for the 60 meter to be activated as well. Did not have any filters, nothing. So was able to get a bamboo pole, stick it up, and get that going. So now I don't do CW, but how do I do low bands, right? Because SSD is not going to cut it. So that's where the FT8 kicks in. So with these antennas that I had set up in the backyard, you had to figure out whether how bad is the interaction, especially when you have multiple computers running, you know, does the RFI get in? So I had to choke all of it. I was able to lay my hands on some of the multiplexers. So that really helped. So I was able to run multiplexers for all these antennas so we could get multiple signals on the bands that are open at any point in time. So that's how the multiple stations kicked in. It's not as easy as people think. People think, hey, you know what? It's autopilot. It runs by itself. There is nothing to be done. That's not true because you got to sit there, keep watching. It'll run. All of a sudden, it's only transmitting. It's not receiving because something happened between the radio to the computer and it's not decoding, right? So you got to see what's happening there, restart, do whatever you need to do as quick as possible. So there is that. And then, again, there's a lot of other things that go on, like people try to beat the system, right? Not send the grid squire, right? And they just send reports. So you got to then shift because the computer software, the flaw in the software keeps calling them back. So there is that. So it's not like, hey, I just set it up and it's on its own. I can just go and have a drink, right? No, you got to watch that. Plus, when the bands are open, it's really open, right? The queue fills up, and I usually set the queue size to like 25. So if the queue size is 25 and I'm running single stream, there is no way I'm able to work everyone that's waiting, right? It's taking its own time. So then you need to bump up the number of queues, simultaneous QSOs that are answered. Now that also is not right because, well, people complain, hey, we were able to copy you minus 18 dB the moment you went to stream, no decode.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge, right? Like, okay, who do you satisfy? Like, are the folks that, you know, should I actually just churn, mow the pile down, you know, with multiple stream, and then maybe the next day, once the weak signals start showing up, then keep going single stream? It's tough. So you got to make a call, like, you know, tweaking the queue size and tweaking the number of streams and watching the feedback and then adapting. And you got to do that times the number of simultaneous stations you're running, keeping an eye on all of it at the same time, and the amplifier and the radio, right? Yeah. So it's not like, okay, yeah, fire it up and you're good to go. You got to be hands-on.
When we're on a de-expedition, Chris, everyone thinks we're having a great time.
Joe, given the choice, right? Given the choice, I would actually get a drink, sit at the beach and not worry about anything, right? And I tell this to folks, hey, I go to Maldives, I go to these islands, There are times where I would even never get my feet into the water.
Yes.
Never get my feet into the water, right? That's it. Maybe I'll get the feet into the water just to run the radials. That's about it.
Yes.
There's no going, having fun, nothing at all. It's, you know, it's worse than work. Work, maybe start in the morning, 7 o'clock. By 9 p.m. I'm done, and then it's off, right? The expedition, it's not the case. It's like maybe you get to sleep like maybe 2-3 hours a day, right? That's about it, because the band is open. Some band is open to somewhere at all times during the day.
Sure.
And people expect you to be there, right? So
yeah,
it's
you
it's
know that.
it is it's worse with going on an expedition than just going on a vacation sipping a, you know, margarita there. So
how many hours a day were you on the air? Because it seemed like you were being spotted around the clock pretty much.
It's so probably I would get a sleep for like maybe 2 hours. And here's what I did. On the second trip, one of my schoolmates, and again, I had someone help me pack all of the equipment, because I took 1,000 pounds, almost 24 pieces of packages, right, to ship. So they came and helped me. And so he wanted to actually join me on the trip because he thought there is some business possibility in that location. So I told him to come over. He finally said, hey, look, you know what? I thought I work hard. Seeing you, with the amount of passion and motivation, this is impossible, right? Like, probably like maybe 2 hours a day, that's it. In the afternoon, there's a sweet spot like in the afternoon where the band basically closes to North America. So all the low bands are gone, 20 is out, right? So maybe 12, 15, 10 is open, and that's the downtime. So just have breakfast and then have like a 2 hour nap or so, and that's about it. Again,
wow.
fire it up again.
So how were the results for your first stop there at VU7A? Were you happy with what you accomplished, or?
I think so. Definitely could have been better. So, you know, like I could have done a little bit better with 60 meter. Did not have the antenna in place, like no fiberglass poles. We had to rig something up. The extra coax I had was faulty, because from the last trip, I think when they wound it back, they damaged the LMR 400. So I was short on a coax. So I had to borrow the coax from 80 to 6, you know, 60 meter. I had to have one or the other. So that was an impact. But otherwise, I think VU7 went well. And in fact, VU7 was more of a test ground for me, thinking, okay, you know what? There has been like a larger activation early in the year, with almost like 60-something thousand QSOs. So pretty much the demand should have gone down. So I just thought, okay, let me go see how this thing works. But the real, test would be in VU4. So the learnings from VU7 should help VU4. That was my plan. But it so turned out that in VU7, things were like hunky-dory and everything went well. No noise, pretty much. And the stations were, you know, operating predictable. Yeah, at times I had to shut down the FT8 software and then bring it up again. But that was the only problem, pretty much, I should say, in VU7. But in VU4, it was a totally different animal. So VU7 wasn't too bad, I think, with the purposeful dupes that you had to offer with FT8. I think it came up to like almost 52,000 something QSOs.
Wow.
And again, it was constrained by the shipping logistics. The schedules changed for the ship. So I had to leave early. So shut down the station early. So I had like maybe 8 days in there. And so if you remove all the dupes, then it came up to like 42,000 QSOs or so. So it was good. I'm sure it can be improved. What I realized is with 5 stations, and again, I just picked a number off the hat, like Wi-Fi, I don't know. I just, you know, had some TS-480s on me, and, you know, I have this 891s I picked up for Cambodia, still sitting here. So I thought, okay, let me take one of that. And for sideband, I need a better radio. So I went and picked up the ASU DX10. So I had like 5. But I think, you know, setting it up and operating, now I would say like you need 7 radios to do anything and be on every band at all times and still satisfy everyone, right? Because, you know, someone when band is open for 160, 80, 40, 30, and then they want 60 meter as well.
Yeah.
Right. And then one of the higher bands are open. One or two higher bands are open as well. Like, hey, come on, 15, come on, 12.
Yeah.
So around like seven radios would be ideal to run parallel at any one point in time. So
let's pause for a minute to hear from one of our great sponsors. You know, I've been talking about DX engineering for quite a while, and I thought it would be better to have someone who is an avid user and appreciates all that DX engineering does and Tim Duffy does for the ham community. So here's Paul, N6PSE, as he's preparing for his H40 Whiskey Alpha D-Expedition.
You know, there's some really terrific organizations and companies out there that sponsor our D-Expeditions that really, really bolster our abilities and really add to that success factor. Tim Duffy and the great folks at DX Engineering are second to none. Just amazing people. And when we contact them, they are very generous and really help us a lot.
Thanks, Paul, for your honest reflection on DX Engineering and how they affect the ham community.
So you left there, you were there until about the middle of December. And then a few days later, you showed up at VU4. So as you were saying earlier, you're going to have to tear down all this equipment carefully this time, right?
Yeah.
Now, how did you get from VU7 to VU4?
Oh, that's a good question, Joe. So it's like sometimes, you know, too confident and, you know, underplanning is bad, right? So here's what happened. So the ship was leaving, I believe, on the 13th. And I was planning to leave VU7 on the 15th. Now, I had picked up the tickets well ahead of time, right, that the flight tickets were actually sold out for far into February, right, past February. The ship tickets were sold out. The person that actually helped move the cargo basically hitchhiked, pulled off some magic. They were able to get the equipment from VU7 back to the mainland, right? So, you know, so what happened was the previous day evening, the ship left on the 13th. On the 12th night, we took down the hex beam, packed it up. After sunset, we shut it down. But I wanted to capitalize on the morning gray line to North America, run the bands through the night, right? 40, 30, especially at sunrise, is pretty good. So I was telling the folks, okay, you know what? My biggest headache is going to be to, you know, roll the coax back, because the LMR-400, as great as it is, but with the solid copper center, solid center conductor, it's a headache. So we went and found wooden spool to roll the coax, and had to make modifications to it so you can actually take one side of the wheel off and remove the rolled coax, all that, right? So, and I told them, okay, the sun comes up like probably around 6 o'clock. So the band closes around 7. So at 7:30 or so, when it closes, I'm going to go and start disconnecting the antenna from the beach. And I'll disconnect the coax. You guys start rolling the coax, right? And then I can come back into the room and start unpacking and disconnecting all the stations. Now, for running 5 stations, QRO, you need power. So I had to actually ship enough cables to run 3-phase power supply from the power panel all the way to the room. And there is actually a box that you can switch between the 3 phases and distribute it to like any of the extension, you know, strips. So I had that. So I had to get the electrician to come in and unhook that at the time. So there was that. So, okay, here's how it started, right? 7:30, I go start taking down the verticals. Now, you need to take it down with the intent to be able to put it back, pack it right, put it back, and plus clean all the salt and sand off of it, right? So it took its own time, and then the sun was out, and it was hot and humid. So I was told, hey, by 10 o'clock in the morning, you need to be ready, everything packed up, right? The ship will probably come at 11, 11:30. And so here comes 9 o'clock. I'm still out at the beach, packing, nothing is done. And they're rolling the coax, all that is still happening. 10 o'clock comes, I'm still at the beach, it's not done. Then I think the 20 to 10 vertical was still in the beach. Then the guys finished the coax and they come and tell Hikrish, you go ahead, you start unpacking, disconnecting everything in the room and unpacking it, right? And we'll take care of the vertical on the beach. So, and start disconnecting the station and packing it all together. And then I was told, okay, the ship has left the other island, so which was good. It's left the other island. It should be back in this particular Agathi's part by like in an hour or so. So they told me like by 11:30, the ship should be here, be ready, right? So, and then they were planning, okay, certain packages were all packed up and ready. So, okay, let's at least move this to the jetty and come back for a second trip, right? So that was the plan. Long story short, it was done. Like everything was finally, it was like just shoving stuff into like whatever you could find and just pack it up and throw it in there. So that's how it all went from VU7 back to Kochi. And the person that helped organize, he went by the ship and took all of it back to the West Coast, right?
So how far was VU7 off of the mainland?
It's not far. In fact, the Puddle Hopper takes about an hour, roughly. So probably, I mean, it's a prop plane. So I would say maybe it flies at, I don't know, 300 miles an hour, maybe. So if it takes an hour, roughly about, say, 300 to 400 kilometers. So it's not far. By a ship, it actually is an overnight journey. It takes like about 20 hours.
Sure. So what's the population roughly on VU7?
Several thousands. There are several islands that are uninhabited, Joe. Kavarthi is the capital, and Agathi is where the airstrip is. In fact, the ship goes to Kavarthi and then it comes to Agathi. So there are like three or four maybe islands that are populated. It's not much. And it's restricted because the folks there are, how can I say this? It's more like a reserve, like the reserve like we have. It's sort of like that, like an Indian reservation. It's sort of like that. They have special rules and all that, right? So probably like, you know, so, I don't know, maybe like between 20 to 40,000, something like that, probably. These islands are small. There is one that actually is larger and it's much further south. Never been there, but it does take, you know, there's no flight to that spot. So have to travel by ship. It's, you know, larger landmass and, you know, it's open for tourists. It's one of the three locations that's open for foreign tourists to go there.
So the next stop becomes VU4. And if I studied the map correctly, it looks like that's actually closer to Thailand than it is to India. Is that correct?
It is. In fact, so folks keep saying like, hey, look, I worked in VU7, so it should be the same in VU4. And I keep telling like, hey, look, VU7 is, you know, maybe it's harder for the West Coast in North America to get to VU7. But for East Coast, I don't know, it's like, it's just pretty close, right? So that's how I see it. And I keep telling like VU4 is like, because from VU7 to Kochi, which is the coastal city on the West Coast, you know, say it's 300 miles roughly, right? From Kochi to Chennai, the flight is about an hour. So, and that's a jet. So it's 500 miles. So roughly you're at, from VU7 to the East Coast, roughly about 800 miles. Now the flight from Chennai to Port Blair, which is VU4, that's like a 2-hour flight, right? It's a jet. So that's like almost close to 1,000 miles. So 1,000 plus 800, roughly around like close to 1,500 miles if you draw a straight line from VU7 to VU4, right? And yeah, it's kind of like called like an hour of black hole there.
Yeah. I have to admit, looking into it, and I'm looking at my map, I didn't realize how big India is. That's one thing I didn't realize. It is a very large country, and it covers a large part of Asia, and then they have VU4 sitting over there closer to Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia than it was India. It's like I knew where it was, but to that detail really surprised me. So that must have been interesting. So how long did it take to get set up there, and you're off and running again?
Yeah, so it's deja vu all over again. So all the equipment had to be shipped by air. And So I was there on, so on the night of 15th, I fly from Kochi, which is on the West Coast, back to home, Chennai, and I had to pick more stuff because everyone was asking for 60 meters. I had to get another fiberglass pole. And I had ordered additional wire because at least in VU7, to tap into the power panel to get three phase wasn't too bad. You know, it was probably maybe like 15 meters or so, like around 40, 50 feet or less. But with the at VU4, I was told it is at least about 150 feet from the room. And I had ordered extra wires. So I had to pick those wires. They're heavy. And I don't know, a few more things I had to pick up. But anyway, another roll of coax, yes. Two more rolls of coax I needed, right? So all of that, packed it up, and had to pick up another pipe to install the fiberglass pole so you can drive it down into the sand or into the water and then install the fiberglass pole. So I had to pick up all of that. So I'm home by around like 10 p.m. So land at 8 something. It's about an hour and a half in the traffic getting home, 10 o'clock. I pick up all of this, pack it up, and at 2 a.m. in the morning, 4 hours later, back on the on a vehicle with all the stuff back to the airport because the flight leaves at like 4:45 in the morning.
Oh my God. Jeez.
And especially when you take the radio and other equipment, you know, you don't know what you will face when you get to the airport, right? So, but it worked out fine. Got all of it sent across, and I land around 7 o'clock. So someone comes in, someone I know picks me up. And I was told, like, okay, wait about an hour, hour and a half, the cargo should arrive. So we go straight to the airport and get a truck, load up all the cargo, go back to the place, you know, we're staying, and then I start beating up the electrician. You know, he never answers my call. He's still snoozing, I guess. So finally, we find someone because need to get the power to the room first. So get that done, and then had to run the coax cables. Again, I've never been to this location, never seen it before. Just the person that helps me with the logistics, and he was saying, like, there's a road that runs. It's a very busy road. And there is a canal that is in close proximity. So he was saying, like, hey, let's get the coax cable under the canal and across and go to the beach right across, right? So, yeah, fine. Except that I would not set my feet into the water in the canal because there is effluent discharge and everything going through it. So hire someone in there, run the cables through, snake it under the canal, take it over to the other side. And this time I changed plans. Rather than setting up the hex beam first, I went and set up the 20 to 10 vertical first. It was easier to set up and tune. So got that running. Once the power was in the room, then I was able to set up the stations in the room as well. And then I found out, I was lucky in VU7 because they had the needed furniture. So it was all good. Just set everything up, done. And when I asked for furniture in VU4, they bring me this rinky-dinky little plastic coffee table, which would not even hold the weight of it, you know, just a transceiver, leave alone having an ACOM sitting on it. So luckily, all the shipping cases that I had to use it for making makeshift table and set all the equipment on that. And also, you need to position it in a way that you have a visual of all the equipment as they're running, right? So you know if SWR is out or anything odd going on with it. So had to set that up. So got the station running with the vertical 20 to 10 vertical, and then went off to install the 30-40 vertical by the beach. And here's what's happening in that location. I've never been here before. There is a seawall across from the water, and above the seawall, there is a bunch of guys selling alcohol. Now, what these guys do is they buy the bottles from the outlets, again, strictly controlled by the Indian government. These guys buy the bottles and they sell retail. So you have guys that come in, drop it in the morning, pay the guy money, have a glass, take off for work. So these guys are there. Now they think I'm actually with the law enforcement trying to install cameras, right? So this becomes a problem, right? So I installed the vertical and we had all the radials, you know, for the 30-40 vertical. It was running fine. And then at night I noticed like the SWR was high, like at one point. So I thought, and the tide comes up like twice in that spot, right? And varies. So I thought like, oh, crap. Did it come in? Did the high tide come in? And did it get submerged? That was my thought. Next day morning, I go there and see, of all the radials I had installed, there's only one radial that was all coiled up along the post. All the other radials are gone, right? I had so many radials for the 30, 40 meter vertical. So the band was open to NA, and there are folks that worked me. So they all worked with that one radial basically that night. Now, if it had been, so my thoughts were like, okay, there is animals walking around. So did the animals get coiled up and they drag it away? But that was not the case. Or if it had been the high tide that had ripped the radial wires. But I looked around, there's a lot of debris. If it is the tide, it takes it and then it's back, you know, it's actually washed ashore. There is no trace of any wire. So I had to then turn around and, okay, this is no good. So I pulled out the vertical from there and then turned around and installed it above the seawall further away. And again, had to go through the whole situation with tuning it and all that, right? So that was there. And now what happens is, my thoughts were like, okay, what's the deal with the 80-160 meter vertical? That's too big to install it on the seawall, especially to lift the whole thing up, hoist it, and then and the 160 needs like four top hats. So it became a challenge, and I think while lifting it is where one of the top hat or two of the top hat wires got caught, and they use like sheet metal for roofing. I got caught, and one of the guys were not paying attention, so it basically, you know, compromised the fiberglass tube. It snapped. So I had to like get a replacement in there. We tried to see if we could fix it, but it was beyond salvage. So we had to get another one and install the next day. So install the fiber. Now, it didn't stop there, right? The 30-40 vertical is up, and then I'm trying to walk to tune. Now, the guys that booze, some of them leave, but there was one guy that was actually laying on the seawall. He was gone, right? He was laying on the seawall. I had to like hop over him, hold a tree on one side, one of the branches from a coconut tree, because the wall is probably about like a feet wide. That's about it. And this chap is laying there. He's thrashed. He's laying there. He's gone, right? Pretty much unconscious. And I hop over him. So, and if he falls on this side into the beach, it's probably a good maybe 13, 14 to 15 feet drop. If he falls on the other side, you know, again, it's another drop on the other side, you know, depending upon which way he falls. But anyway, I heard that luckily he actually walked when he regained consciousness and, you know, sobered up, he walked. So, which was good. But all the radials, and I had to get the radials over the seawall out into the beach, right? So we can actually pick up some of the saltwater effect. So that was where the 30-40 vertical was. And the 160-80 vertical, I had to get a replacement fiberglass tube shipped. It came in. This time I installed it down on the shore. And that's when we started picking up the noise. So, and the funny part was, all right, so we had the verticals installed, then had the hex beam installed on the top of the building so we could actually do some 6 meter from the hex beam. So had that installed. And then is when we started seeing the horrendous noise at nighttime. The sun rises at 5:30 in the morning. It's like out bright, sunny, and it's gone at 5:30 in the evening. It sets like every day. So at 5:30 in the evening, the streetlights come up. When the streetlights came, noise comes. And sometimes, many times the power goes out. So when the power went out, the noise goes away because the place had a generator. The generator kicks in. No noise. It's good at night. So there were times where I was able to run low bands when the generator was on before the street, you know, the power, the city power came back on. So, and in the morning it's gone. So that was an observation, but I couldn't explain. The 20 to 10 vertical that was in the beach was not susceptible to that noise at all, right? Hmm. But the hex beam that was on the top of the building, gone. 20 meter couldn't hear anything. It was that bad.
Oh.
It picked up. So I had the noise, one of the noise canceller boxes where you can actually bring in the sense antenna. So I was trying to use the hex as a sense antenna. and use the vertical as a transmit to see if I could do something. But, you know, it's still a compromise. You lose the signal coming in from the transmit antenna. So try to do it. It worked in some capacity, wasn't ideal. So that's when we thought, okay, you know what? Let's do this. Let's move the 30-40 vertical back from the seawall out into the water. If the 2010 vertical is not susceptible to the noise, just because it's further away from the building and the street power line, let's move it away. So move the 30-40 vertical out into the water. Did not help much. So then I thought, okay, let's try to move the 160-80 vertical even further out into the water. I'm not a big fan of it, but got to try. And I had, you know, some of our folks say, like, what you do is you just shut everything down, go and scout another location, and then reinstall, right? Like, the problem with that approach is I have to now go and disconnect the power line, the whole 50 meters for the three phase, shut up all the stations, pack it all up, shut down the verticals, right? It'll take time, probably lose another day, day and a half to scout, find out, cut a deal, all that, right, with the new place. So decided, okay, let's try without much disruption, let's move the verticals out further away from the water, from the shore, from the buildings, out into the water. Now, that coax roll that was used to connect the 160-80 vertical was almost 450 feet, so 150 meters out from the building. So then what we realized was, again, the thoughts were, if it was QRN coming in from the power lines, maybe it's local and we pick it up from the braid of the coax. That was not the case. You disconnect the coax, you just touch the connector on the radio, on the back of the radio, with just the center conductor from the PL239. Nice. So it's not being picked up from the braid. So anyway, so that was an impairment, and I know a lot of folks are frustrated. I mean, I get frustrated. I run, you know, keep calling the DX, and the DX is not hearing me, right? Like, people complain saying, like, hey, I'm running so much power, and it's a waste of time. I spent 20 hours. So, you know, Joe, like you said, it would have been a best time to shut everything down, go get that martini, and then sit on the beach somewhere, right? But then my thoughts were like, okay, you know what? At least those folks that have the ability to overcome the noise ceiling on my receive will be able to get through, right?
Right.
If they're able to put up stronger signal and maybe it gets passed, I don't know, or it could be plain luck, like when the power went out and then it was on generator and it was able to still work, folks.
Let's take a break to learn about the Daily DX.
Hey, I just poured you a cup of coffee. You look pretty happy. How'd you do?
I worked him on the third call. Can you believe it?
You worked him on the third call? Seriously? I thought you just had that little pistol station.
I do, but I have a secret weapon.
A secret weapon? What is it?
Information. I knew when they were on the air, their operating habits. Heck, I even knew the equipment they're using. I just had to be there when they came up on the band. I even beat the spotting network.
Wow, how'd you manage all that?
I get the Daily DX from Bernie, W3UR. In addition to the weekly and daily bulletins, I also receive special notices when things change in real time. I feel that I'm always on top of every DXpedition.
So now you just need to confirm it, right?
Yep, that's it. Bernie even helps me with that, giving me QSL routes and QSL managers if they don't use LOTW. The Daily DX is a DX bulletin sent via email to you Monday through Friday. It includes DX news, IOTA news, QSN reports, QSL information, a DX calendar, propagation forecast, and much, much more. With a subscription to the Daily DX, you will also receive DX news flashes and other interesting DX tidbits. Bernie's been an integral part of my confirming over 300 entities and WAZ while operating a modest station.
W3UR Bernie is the editor, a member of the DX Honor Roll, a member of the 3000 Challenge Club, as well as the editor of the How's DX column in QST. He is uniquely positioned to have his finger on the pulse of the DX community and shares this information weekly. Why not let Bernie be your secret weapon?
You can get a free 2-week trial at www.dailydx.com.
Now let's go have that cup of coffee and tune around.
What would you do different? You know, you've been on these 2D expeditions because everything is the same. You had to move everything, so it's really 2D expeditions. What, if anything, would you do different?
Joe, the one big thing this time I realized was scouting the location. You know, don't assume, right? Check for the noise levels, right? Because everything is changing. And it turned out to be, I think it's pretty much from the street lights, the LED lights, right? And plus, of course, every device that is installed talks these days. So there's no telling. If possible, that particular location, unless it's a remote island where there is no infrastructure, nothing, have to test for noise levels first. Yeah. Take a radio, sure. Test it. So that's so I have left some device with my contact. So, you know, in the future, they'll be able to scout a location both during daytime and nighttime to make sure, right, there is no noise in those parts. Because, you know, you need everything, right? You need cooling for the equipment. And we've seen this happen in the past where you have equipment running in a marine environment. And if it runs for even a few weeks with the air circulating in for ventilation, the salt, you know, corrodes the connectors over time. It's not immediate, but maybe a year, 2 years later, you can actually find salt corrode the connectors. And we've lost equipment in the past. So, and when you have like so much running and you're pushing the limits, you need the cooling, required cooling for it. At one point, the air conditioning went out and I was hammering, you know, the owner to fix the air conditioning by removing it from another facility and then sticking it here saying, hey, the temperature is rising, right? It's now at like 25, 26, 27, 28 degrees. I'll start losing equipment at this rate. It's running hot. So, you know, got to have power, got to have adequate cooling. Need to be near salt water so the antennas are efficient. Right. And you know, again, noise turned out to be the big wild card and Murphy, and it turned out, you know, so.
Yeah, the noise is always a problem. And I told Bill, one of our friends, unfortunately, is a silent key, but he always told me, if you can't hear them, you can't work them. So that's the whole thing. You really need a quiet environment, if possible.
Well, you know what you really underscore is something we talk a lot about on this particular series, and that is, it's like when somebody's sitting at their house and they can't work you, they get frustrated. And then when they finally do work you, then they switch off and now they're looking for somebody else. But you still have to deal with everything. You still have to pack up. You got to get home safely, and then you got to get rid of the equipment. You got a QSL, you got to do all those chores that those of us have not done it before. We're just sitting there going, boy, I can't believe I didn't get him on 20. What was he thinking? Why weren't his hours better? Blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
The funny thing about this one was, I think I worked you several times from VU7. I heard you very well. I had no issues. I never heard you on VU4. And now, obviously, it could have been conditions and everything else, but it was just, I thought sure in those 8 or 10 days I'd be able to work you a second time. I just never heard you. And I don't have a superstation or anything, but so how did you end up doing there on VU4 then?
So not too well, because you know the nighttime low bands pretty much, you know, couldn't hear folks right on the receive end. So I think we ended up probably like around 25K, almost like less than half of the QSOs at, you know, at VU7. But yeah, I mean, perhaps if the noise was overcome well, then probably would have done a lot better, yeah. You know. But there is that. It's the same antenna setup, same equipment, right?
Yeah, yeah,
nothing
yeah.
Nothing yeah. changed. But again, like I said, it's like, it's a different animal. It's so far out into, you know, deeper into Asia that it's not the same. Now, I think I had like from VU7, I think we had 46 folks that actually worked me on 160.
Okay.
On VU7. And I think there were a few hundred that were able to get in the logs on 80. Right. In VU4, it was one.
Oh,
Really?
There was one ham from W7 call area in the West Coast that got into 160.
Gee.
Right?
Wow.
So, yeah, if it had not been for the noise, because pretty much it was a problem, right? Like I lost the ability to run, receive 160 and 80 at night, which is where the noise levels are very disruptive. Again, same thing with 30, 40 at night. Europe, parts of Europe, then you lose the ability to run them. 60 meters, the same thing. Where it worked is in the mornings when it's gray line, when the lights go out, the noise is out, the QRN is out, then you have like that an hour to 2 hour window to run 30 and 40. So that's where it is like, okay, I need to now get as many folks in the queue as possible and then mow the pile down and increase the number of simultaneous QSOs, right? So you got like the 2 hour window from say 5:30 in the morning till like 7 roughly, 40 closes sooner, 30 is open much little bit longer. So that was pretty much the opportunity there without the noise. So, but yeah, next, you know, I think anyone looking for any other locations, yeah, just make sure that, you know, the noise levels are good. But this one turned out to be more problematic than you like, anticipate. Like, for example, I was telling earlier, Joe, like, yeah, you start packing stuff up thinking like, hey, what if I need this? What if I need that, right? Like, so I packed up one of the induction soldering guns that we have here. Radio Shack used to make one. I had like the 100 watt. I had that because some of the coax that was used in the past, in case I need to snip and then solder a new connector to it because it had corroded or whatnot, right? I had that heavier gun. I was not planning to use it, but this time I had to use it, right? I had to do that. Then two of the TS-480s, which were used in VU-7, unpack, ship it across in VU-4, again, you know, pack it up in VU-7, ship it, unpack in VU-4, set it, you plug in. There are this round, I don't know, 6 or 8 pin DIN connector that is used to actually pick up and send audio in and out to the radio. I don't know what happened. Two of the radios, the audio input to the radio failed. So it's something with the circuitry. I've kind of reset the radio, wiped out all the settings, reconfigured, no go, right? Luckily, I had something else for a backup, which I think in those old 480s, it's got the little RJ45 connector on the front for the microphone.
Yeah.
So I had made a breakout box. It's probably laying somewhere around here. It's basically to apply bias to the microphone that you use for a computer headset. So the little box has a couple of batteries in there and provides a bias, and then it provides audio back to the radio. So I had that box. And in the past, I used to use the 480, so it had a little piece of wire hanging out with an RJ45 connector on the end, which is wired for 480. So I actually plugged that in and used the headset, and I was able to transmit through the radio. So that's when I knew the circuitry is fine. It's just that the audio input part of the connector, the DIN connector, went bad, right? So then I sent someone off to the store to go and buy 3 feet long internet cables, cut it, and had to solder that, because otherwise I'm down two radios. So you got to fix that, right? So fixed that, and then I got that working. And that's when, of course, the 160-80 vertical break. So we get the fiberglass pole the next day, get that installed. And then the 60-meter vertical down there in the beach, it's like you got a reef further out into the water, but then there is an opening in the beach where there's a channel. So the waters come out through the channel. And then what I had was I had installed the 60-meter vertical along the fringes of the water coming from the channel. I hit the jackpot, right? Like, it was good. It was working fine, all tuned. And this is the night I had it, the day I had it installed. At that night, there is this huge log that comes through the channel. It's probably used for building some part in a big boat or something. It's probably about like 8+ inches in diameter. This thing comes, it gets washed in the high tide. It just flips and rolls and coils up the coax, the radials, and it uproots the whole pipe that's, you know, driven down into the soil. The 12-meter fiberglass pole crashes and it cracks at the top. right? The whole thing is a coiled up mess in the beach, right? Now, the funny part was the vertical wire that was used to make the 60 meter vertical, it worked fine at VU7. You disconnect that, you bring it over, and the thing never tuned. And I could not figure out what it was. I thought it was a connector, but you know, the antenna analyzer, the VNA doesn't show resonance anywhere. Then long story short, I took the wire, went back, put a multimeter between the two ends, and I found out that the insulation was 100% perfect. The wire had melted somewhere in between.
Oh.
So I had to replace the wire, and then bam, within the first instance, it's resonant, right? Like I spent like over a day and a half trying to muck around with that, like take the connector back, install a different connector there, solder that, and try different things. But yeah, it so turned out. So once I got that working, then the tide comes back with this bamboo and it thrashes it, right? So, and then, oh. Go ahead, Joe, you had a question.
Thinking about all this, with a guy going out on by yourself, one-man D expedition, would we be better off not to get on 80 and 160?
Well, if you don't do it, you're going to get 100 emails.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, what about 80? What about 160, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, in fact, if it was for the amount of effort required to install the antenna, it wasn't too bad, Joe. You know, in fact, having put the antenna together here in North Carolina and tried it, I got a hang of how long it takes, right? The way the top hats are built, again, since it's a fine wire, it has to be handled carefully so that they don't get tangled up, but it can be done, right? So that was the easy part. Dealing with the noise was the hard part, right? Now, had this antenna been on the shore, no problem, similar to what it was in VU7, right? VU7, I had a problem with the antenna, partly because I use the same mast to run 160, and then I was running 80 and 75 in close proximity. You have those spacers, nylon spacers, that I think DX Commander offers with the holes to run the parallel vertical wires. But then once it gets to the very top, which is where the high voltage point is, the wires have to be separated. But I did have a pulley up there because then you don't have much leeway with the 160 because it's what it is, right? The vertical wire, you can prune at the bottom, but if it is off, it's a meter long. You need to prune a meter, 2 meters to change the resonance for 160. But for 80, I had the pulley so I could actually quickly hoist it down and change the length. Now, what happened was that pulley from Radio Shack is a nice stainless steel pulley. So the pulley was actually going through the wire. Sorry, the wire was going through the pulley out, and it was in close proximity to the 160 vertical wire at the very high point, right, which is where the high voltage is. So one time, the 160 meter vertical wire just cut. It just got cut with the high voltage, right? And when I brought the whole thing down, I had to like solder it. And then I found out that the 80 meter wire, the insulation has already started melting. So it was heating up at that spot. So now I know you can't keep the metal pulley. So I had a nylon block. I was able to offset it from the 160 and then install the pulley. That worked. So no, 160, 80, very easy to install, up and running, Joe. No problem. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, next time, lesson learned, don't install antennas near a channel. Be ready for bamboos coming in, right? If antenna is not resonant, it's probably the wire is cut, but the insulation is 100% perfect, right? So a few things like that. And tell people if there are bootleggers nearby, tell them that. And people took the wires too. They say like, hey, this wire looks cool. Did you bring it from overseas? Like, yeah, it's pretty cool, right? Its quality is pretty good. I tell them, this wire is in salt water. Once it's inside salt water, you run it for wiring inside the home. I told it'll melt. So you cannot use it, right? So you got to offer a poison pill there. So yeah, there are some learnings, and every time, everywhere you go, there is something or the other to learn, Joe. So
wow.
Yeah.
Let's pause so we can hear from a DX club that is one of our sponsors.
DXing is even more enjoyable when you make connections with other DXers. A major sponsor of this podcast is the Southwest Ohio DX Association, or SWODEXA. SWODEXA is best known for hosting the DX Dinner and DX Forum, as well as the DXpedition of the Year Award. All these DX events are held annually in conjunction with Hamvention and are among the most well-attended and notable DX events of the year. Joining Swodexa will give you access to a great group of DXers, an informative newsletter, preferred seating at the DX dinner and the DX forum, and you will be supporting DX expeditions to the top 50 needed DXCC entities. Check us out at www.swodxa.com and click on the membership info tab for more information and a registration form.
Wow. What an exciting time.
Very interesting, ain't it, Bill?
So you were gone the better part of a month then, basically?
Yeah, pretty much I left. So here's what happened. I mean, I left on Thanksgiving and flew down. And I had the opportunity to work from VU. So I used the daytime to pull all the equipment, pack it up, and I had to go to the airport to hand it off to the air cargo because of the shipping logistic, because the ship that was supposed to leave early on a particular date got canceled. So that was making it, the next departure was cutting it too close. So every time I had something packed up, I went ahead to the air cargo and shipped it off. So I had to go three times during the week to pack everything, ship it, hand off everything that was ready. And nighttime, I used to do my work to cover my U.S. East Coast time. So I did that. And then Friday was over. Saturday, I was on the plane, go down. I was on the West Coast. And then the next day morning was a puddle hopper. So I went there. So that was on the 3rd. I was there in VU7. So, but the permission kicked in, I think, on the night of the 6th, like midnight, right? 5th to 6th midnight. So I had like a couple of days, so I had the time to install everything. It was easy. So from 3rd till the 11th, or actually 13th, I was able to operate in VU7, right? From the 6th through the 13th, so around eight days. So 13th shut down, back to mainland on the 15th. Then 16th, installed it in VU4. 16th through till 27th was when the permission was available. So then 27th finished it. After the gray line on the morning of the 28th, started tearing it everything down. I think the flight was supposed to leave by 1, so I had to hand over the cargo by like 11. So from the morning, 7 o'clock, started tearing down everything. So at night, by midnight this time, lesson learned, start packing everything indoors. Everything was packed up. The next day morning, and the hex beam came down the same day. But at night, had the vertical still out in the beach, because from sunset, which is 5:30 p.m. till midnight, still there was an opportunity to run some stations, right? So right. Kept it running. And next day morning, around like sun comes out at like 5:30, I was out there taking everything down. So wow. This time, yeah, was able to beat the deadline.
You know, you sound a lot like when I first met Joe 20 years ago at a DX meeting. I knew he'd been to Wake and Swains and all these places. And I said, hey, I've got this little wire and a vertical and stuff. What's one thing I got to know about? And he says, what do you know about the gray line? I said, well, I know what it means, but I don't really do anything with it. Oh, you got to change that in a hurry. And ever since I've known him, he's preached the gray line. So
I'm pretty much on the gray line twice a day, always in the morning because I get up early anyway. And then in the evening, if I'm home, my wife would tell you, I'm sitting in here on that gray line. Sometimes you work a new one or two, and sometimes you don't, but you got to be there.
Which is so true. Like, I've had, folks always ask, right, like, hey, look, VOA cap is saying band should be open at 12, right, like on 12 meters. So at that time, you have to be there, right, to see whether it is or not.
Yes.
There was one time where, was on 15, which was awesome because the band was open to North America and had a lot of folks work on 15 from VU4. The next day, the same time,
Nothing.
15, nothing. 12, right? Like, then it's just a matter of like trying to hop around and find which one is open.
Yeah.
To at least conform to the VOA cap predictions, right? So it's tricky, which is what makes it fun too, right?
Yes, I was going to say that's what makes this all interesting.
Totally
is the chase.
Indeed,
So,
yeah.
You catch them one day or you may not catch them. It's like fishing.
That's
You
right.
never know when they're going to bite.
So for VU7 and VU4, is there if someone wanted to contribute $20 or $30 or something to help offset all your costs, is there a way they might do that?
It's on ClubLog. Well, again, QRZ has the pertinent information, right? So it's available there. And ClubLog also has an option to, you know, contribute if folks have to. But again, like I said, this time it's more like, okay, I'm actually going to go there just to try this stuff out, right? Like, so just fun. I want to see if the multiplexers chain work. I can have two bands on the same antenna with two radios running without one killing the other's receiver, right? Does it work? Do all these radios simultaneously play well at the same time? So it was more of an experiment pretty much. And, yeah. You know, so again, that's why I was saying like, hey, look, no, and also it's more like, I don't want to ask for sponsorship and not be able to deliver, right? I would rather do it the other way, right? So it's like, so yeah, that and thanks for all the folks that, you know, were able to sponsor. I know I did not do a good job like I've done it in the past, which is have all their call signs listed. Just no time. In fact,
sure.
Spent all the time trying to test the antennas and trying to test and see if the sound cards work without RFI getting into the radios, right? To the point where in some cases, and especially this applies to the radios that were actually sitting in VU, just taking it and just firing it up, right? You don't know if it's being overdriven, the ALC is adjusted. That, you know, I did get some feedback and help from folks and we were able to get that adjusted. But, you know, there is no amount of preparation and planning, you know, is sufficient, right? There is always something or the other that comes up.
So I have to ask, how many, I'm an IT guy also, and I'm curious how many laptops you took with you. Because, you know, the old rule of thumb is if you have one, you have zero. And if you have two, you've really only got one.
Yeah.
So you need three to have two.
Which is true. So, you know, what I did, Bill, was I only took two. But again, these are fairly newer laptops. And I was running MSHV. I had N1MM on both so that either one I could actually, you know, if I had to do voice or if someone, again, I'm not a CW operator. I can't do pile up, but I can pick up some call. If someone really, really wants that one QSO, I can give them a QSO right on CW. I had the little keyer as well for CW. But I had two laptops and I've tested them, you know, back here in the station, running them simultaneously. That's how I was able to iron out some of the kinks in the system, right? Like I had two sound cards that I had to disregard because they were fine working by themselves. But when you have two radios running simultaneously and running QRO at the same time, there is something inside the circuitry. They're not happy with each other. So I had to discard them, right? So tested them and made sure that, you know, the laptop was not getting shut down because of RFI or any issue. So pretty stable. So just two laptops. I was able to run on one, I would run like maybe three instances of FT8 software. On the other, I would run two. Sometimes, so, you know, it'll get into a funky state. Then I would actually have to move the radio from this to the other laptop and fire it up again. It's, again, challenging with the changing in the COM ports, right? All that. But so you need to be nimble enough to be able to move and then make sure that you're able to get the clock synced or recover the clock back from the signals that you're picking up. Internet was still unstable. So, you know, I had to get like one of my cell phone and turn it into a hotspot because there was wireline internet they installed after a few days at VU7, but sometimes it's just gone. So I had to take my cell phone, turn on the hotspot because it was at least not too bad. I could get like 5 or 6 Mbps, put it in a plastic bag and hang it by the grill on a window in the back because from that spot it would pick up the signal, but if I move it towards the main entry door, no signal, right? I have to walk like maybe like 30, 40 feet away from the front. Probably it's just the buildings, concrete buildings blocking the pathway of the signal. But anyway, if I put it on the window, it was working. So I was able to get internet and then turn on live stream because it doesn't matter. You know, the goal was to eliminate any clowns getting in there, getting in the way of dreams from the the DXers chasing, right? Disappointing them. So the goal was to avoid that to the extent possible to keep live stream going. There is always something.
Well done. I know from a couple of the sites I was doing some research for our discussion tonight, just a tremendous amount of positive feedback. So I think you made a lot of guys happy. And again, I think it underscores what we always talk about here is that this is just not, you're not just going to the beach and blowing up a raft and getting on the radio. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of work and expense and risk. The only thing I might ask as a favor is when you go to VU4 next time, I'll send you a few bucks and see if you can talk to those bootleggers for me, because
No, they're all buddies now, right? Like here's the fun part. I turned around and hired him for some labor, right? Some muscle. I mean, yeah, when you have to actually move the 160 meter vertical and then you have to lift it upright and then stick it into the
pipe.
The post, into the pipe, right? So yeah. You need some help, especially to tip it over and to take it down. So you just hire some of the local guys and then they're happy, right? And
yeah.
As long as they know you're not, you know, you don't have cameras to trap them, they're all good.
See, I never thought of doing that. That's
No, you know what the funny part was? I asked them, like, you know, it's like a whole ecosystem there. There's this little makeshift house, and then the bootleggers are there. The owner of the home, and I keep asking, like, hey, look, that's they're on your land, right? Like, are you not afraid? Or the guy that's selling retail, he says, like, hey, the cops are being paid off, so don't worry about it. It's like, okay. So it's still interesting. I mean, when I was in VU7, there was actually a radar station close by, and they had to come. They were coming in and were curious, right? Because they said, like, oh, we have to write it in our security report what's going on in case we get asked. So they came and started asking what it is. The person that owns the place, he came and took pictures of the back of the whole setup. He said, like, is this good? And I have had people that came and asked, like, is this going to be permanently left here, right? Given the amount of equipment and wiring, right?
Yeah.
So they were, you know, pretty curious about the amount of work. They said, like, did it take you like a day, 2 days to install all this? I said, like, no, 2 hours,
sure.
Less than 2 hours. It took more time to unpack and set it in its place than wire it, right? Wiring was the quickest. It does take some level of discipline, especially if you're doing solo with multiple radios running QRO. It takes a lot of discipline because with the multiplexer chain and the filters and all that, you only make one change at one point in time, right? Because when the gray line closes in the morning and you need to shift the radios over to the higher bands, you might be back behind the radio. Hey, I've got like two cables. I know these two cables. I can, but you know, A, make sure you shut the radio down. Nothing is transmitting.
Yeah.
And then it's being very disciplined because in spite of being so methodical, there was one time where I started unscrewing and it starts sparking, right? I was like, oh my God, it's still transmitting, right? Like no matter. So in my mind, I keep thinking like, okay, 30 meter radio goes to 12 meters. 40 meter radio goes to 15, and I see that, I shut that radio, walk behind, recable it, come back, and I switch that radio back to the target band, and then I go off with the next one, right? Because one mistake and you lose something there, and it's irreplaceable.
Yeah.
So, unbelievable. Yeah. And then you made it home safely?
I did, yeah. Came back, back to mainland, went straight from the airport. I had one of my friend send me a truck. I told him, just send me a truck. I need some help to, you know, muscle power to unload it once it's home because it's 1,000 pounds, like 24 pieces. I can't lift it. It has to go up. And so luckily, all of it came in, no damages. And then my mom turned around and said, like, hey, look, what is it? So I cover everything with like a large tarp. And so she pulled it aside and said, like, hey, compared to the last time, you accumulated more stuff. I said, like, she asked, like, when did you bring all this? I said, like, oh, every trip I came, I just brought some. So it's all there. Right. So she's like, it's here. But Yeah, so no, it's all there. And then once it's back, it doesn't end there, right? You got to take out all the coax, again, wash them, the pipes, the fiberglass pole, inventory them, see what, you know, which ones have any damage, and then plan to have that replenished for the next trip. Yeah, pretty much, you know, all the vertical wires, radials, everything has to be washed, dried, and repacked, you know, and hopes that next time it's still, you know, functional, right? So,
yeah, there was one thing Joe told me, and I guess he was on Swain's, and, you know, it's 95 or 100 degrees F, and he said the problem is you can stay hydrated, but you're drinking water that's 95 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, because it's not like you can put it in the refrigerator. So,
yeah,
over the last year, I've gotten so much more educated, so much more empathy for you guys that are willing to do this, because it's a massive undertaking. It really is. Just to go so I can talk to you, basically, right? So, my goodness, my hat's off to both you guys. Just major, major challenge. And that was really, really interesting. Joe, did I miss anything?
No, I think we covered about everything. We went through all the notes, and I think we're good, Bill.
And the next trip will be T42T? Is that what you
said? Yeah, coming Sunday. I just sent my out-of-office notification and said, like, you know, Christian international trip, no access to, you know, any company resource. That's it. So I'm gone, like gone.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about that, and we'll get some listeners to chase you guys down?
So the plan is like WB2REM. Jim has been there before, so Jim kind of put this together. So I think like 6 months ago, Jim was asking like, hey, you know, we have this coming. Do you want to go? I said like, okay, sign me up, right?
Yeah.
So it's like six of us going from into Cuba, and then I think there are like six operators from Cuba. The plan is, I think I'm actually out there Sunday, Monday. The rest of the folks are actually flying in from Miami, and so again, I know Jim was saying like, "Hey, look, we need time to recuperate." Like, what the heck? It's like a little puddle hopper across, like an hour and a half. Jim, no, there is no time to acclimate, right? You should be up and running from touchdown to take off, right? So my wife was saying like, Jim is going to regret taking you, you know.
Yeah, so, Jim, so I've never met Jim, but I know him. He was WB2REM. He's been kind enough to allow me to reprint a couple of his CQ articles in our newsletter. And I used to, when I had a rig in the car, I would check into his 40-meter net occasionally in the morning. So I may have to shoot him an email and tell him we were on this. But he's a heck of a nice guy and a great operator. And I'm sure you'll have fun down there. And I'm looking forward to working you guys. So, and I may work you a bunch of times, so I know I get you. So does that count? Is that okay?
Sure. You know, so I think, yeah, the plan is, you know, setting up the antennas on, I think, Thursday.
Okay.
And prepare. So Thursday, I think, through the weekend, right? And then start tearing it down. So they have like a special location outside the city, kind of like on a cliff. They checked the noise levels and gave a thumbs up today. So it's looking good.
Great, great. Well, I will, I'm going to reserve a seat for you at the DX dinner. And if you know you're coming, and we'd certainly love to meet you in person. And like I said, I'll set aside a cold beverage, and Joe always has a cooler with him at the DX dinner. So, But Chris, cool. I really want to appreciate you share. Tell you how much I appreciate you sharing all this with us, and your passion is just great. I love it, and you're obviously having fun while you're doing this, and you're working your tail off. But you're getting better at it, and you're having fun, and I appreciate you doing it, because I got an all time new one from VU7, and hopefully I'll get you to VU4 someday as well. So thanks again.
Yep. No. Thank you, Bill, and thanks to the DXers out there for the encouragement and playing and making it fun, and, you know, the chase, right? So,
yeah. Well, thank you very much, Chris. Nice to meet you. Thanks for the cues that I got off both of those trips. I appreciate that. And like Bill said, we'll see you at Dayton, buddy.
Yep. Thank you, Joe. Looking forward to it. Bill,
thanks a lot.
Good evening.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Was that interesting or what? Thank you for joining us on this edition of the DX Mentor. I would also like to thank my guests, Krish, W4VKU, and Joe, WAGEX. I would certainly like to thank our sponsors, ICOM America, The Daily DX, DX Engineering, and the Southwest Ohio DX Association. You won't find anyone more committed to DX than these sponsors. I would love to have your feedback, answer your questions, and provide help with any DX or amateur radio issues that you may have. If you need clarification on something or just have a question, email me at thedxmentor@gmail.com. Please drop me a line if you've achieved an all-time new one, received recognition, or have a DX event that you would like us to mention. I'd be happy to do that. If you are enjoying these DX Mentor episodes, please hit the subscribe button. You can also click like if you found this one particularly interesting. If you don't want to subscribe, please drop me a note and let me know why. I really want to make this a DX podcast and YouTube episode. Well, 73's for now, and thanks to my XYL, Karen, for her love and support. I'll see you in the pileups.